nanohub.org.
You can follow along with this presentation using printed slides from the NanoHub. Visit www.nanohub.org and download the PDF file containing the slides for this presentation. Print them out and turn each page when you hear the following sound. Enjoy the show.
Okay, good afternoon, everyone. Thanks for the introduction. I didn't realize I was number one, so in this series. What I'd like to present is numerical work and nanoelectronic modeling work that I've been doing over the last 10 years or so. And the reason why the JPL logo is on the bottom is that a lot of the results that I'm showing today have been generated while I was still at JPL. So I want to acknowledge that. The title of this talk is Parallel Computing for Holistic Nanoelectronic Simulations. And I, as I described in the abstract, parallel computing has been sort of been useful for an aloof few people, really, until about 7 or 8 years ago. And it was mostly because these machines have been largely unaffordable. So a typical parallel computer used to cost around $2 million. And people at national labs or people that had written proposals to get onto such machines have had access to it. But from an engineering point of view, these machines have been largely ignored. And when I was interviewing at JPL, I told my boss to be, I think supercomputers are utterly useless. Now, he was the group supervisor of the supercomputing group there. And he said, well, you might change your attitude. We're just introducing Beowulf computing, cluster computing. That was in 1997. And it did change my attitude because it provided me with computer access to parallel computers for hours and days and months on time, where I, as an engineer and a scientist, can actually utilize these computers. So that's a sort of the background of this presentation. And then I'd like to give you an overview of parallel computing paradigms and how you parallelize code, and then I give you concrete examples of how that was being utilized. All right. Okay. All right. So the motivation of my work really in the last few years is that if you buy anything from the semiconductor industry today, like a chip in this computer, a chip in a PC, they're really completely based on this tripod where devices are typically simulated first. Circuits are certainly simulated to the umpth degree before they're even being put into production. And then they're fabricated and characterized. For device models, that has become more and more prevalent, but it wasn't as heavy on simulation. I believe on the nanometer scale, simulation is going to be a key element because you cannot always break apart your device to figure out what you have built. You have too big of an exploration space to explore. But the problem is such tools really don't exist. So what the NCN is all about is try to generate tools in the area of nanoelectronics, nanoelectromechanics, and nanobio, combined with work with computational science that enables the solution of large-scale simulations. So we want to develop these software approaches and these modeling approaches, but we also want to deploy them. And deployment for us means we want to make them available to the community on the NanoHub. So my encouragement here to the students is whenever you build these modeling tools and get your insight, I would encourage you to talk with us and get engaged with us because you will be able to put your modeling tool on the NanoHub. So on the NanoHub right now, we have a variety of online simulations. It's about 30 tools or so. And what we're about to do is to replace all the old static online simulation tools that we have with interactive tools where you play with parameters on the screen, you get results immediately. It's going away from the batch submission process where you have a web form, you fill it out, and put it on into a computing queue and get your results. This is actually an interactive way of doing this. We also have courses and tutorials. SuperData 659 is completely on the website. We have learning modules that help you combine lectures and simulation tools so you can actually explore that and learn about these tools, and teachers can use these tools to teach classes. We have seminars, we have animations, and we have collaboration environments. And the collaboration environment is really kind of neat. I'm using it actually for my own work, where I'm connecting with people that are in Munich and in Australia simultaneously. We share files, look at the same file, and we talk to each other. But last not but least, we have real users. So last year we had over 6,000 users that ran, 1,000 of which ran over 70,000 simulations. So this online simulation environment of the NCN is something that's actually being used, and it's not just a gimmick. So now we're trying to push that into a variety of fields in nanoscience. The way that actually works is you connect to the NanoHub on the internet, you go to nanohub.org, and say you click on a tool, and that tool connects you through some unique middleware to some physical machine. And in the old ways, you might fill out some batch forms and on the web browser and basically submit a job into a queue, and you get your results back. Right now, we're replacing the whole batch processing with a remote desktop and a virtual machine, so it gives us a sandbox to play in for you guys to deploy your software in as well, and we make that interactive. The key is now that we can distribute these jobs here also onto a job manager, and that job manager can distribute the work onto clusters and to parallel computers. So that's basically bringing me to the topic of this presentation. Why would you want to use parallel computers? And how would you do it, and then what are the application areas that you do that in? So why would you want to do parallel computing? Well, one major reason is serial computation might require too much time, or you don't have the resources to even put the problem onto a single CPU. Right? So I just got an email two months back, somebody saying, I need 50 gigabytes of RAM. I'm like, good luck. Right? We have one machine that actually has 120 gigabytes of RAM, but it also costs $1 million. So these things are really expensive. So the available resources, as I mentioned in the beginning, were traditional parallel computers, which have shared memory, and they're typically expensive if you compute, if you're based on floating point operations per dollar. Okay, that's for me the ultimate metric. How much money do I have to spend to get my work done? Now these cluster computers or Beowulfs are really chunks of PCs. That's how they started out with. But the whole industry is really going to build clusters right now. And even the big supercomputers are really clusters of clusters. Now, the objective, if you do parallel computing, is you want to distribute your workload on N CPUs. Right? So you have N CPUs, and you have work to be done. And what you want to do is, or the best you can possibly do is, you can divide your serial compute time by N. That's as good as you can do. So you want to, that is your ultimate goal. So that means at any given time, you always have to keep the CPUs busy, right? They always have to work. Anytime they don't work, well, that reduces your advancement that you have here. So you want to maximize the work on each CPU. You want to minimize communication between CPUs, okay? Communication is your enemy, really. So when you talk, you don't work. I mean, I'm working right now, but generally speaking, when you talk, you don't work. And certainly that's true on a parallel computer. So what are the typical technologies for parallelization? Well, the cheapest one, so to speak, is batch processing with shells. Say you want to run 100 bias points of your simulation tool, and the bias points are completely independent of each other, and you have one executable. Well, you can think of just running it 100 times and dishing it out to multiple jobs into the queue, right? So these are independent executables, so you have trivial parallelization. So that's sort of one end of trivial. There's another end of trivial is that is there's automated compiler-based parallelization, where some tools, some sophisticated compilers, you can say, well, make it parallel. So they take a loop that you might have, and they try to parallelize that loop. From a practical sense, that is typically limited to 4 or 8 CPUs. If you try to parallelize bigger than that, you just don't get a speed up, so it doesn't help much. So those are the two trivial ones I know of. Then there's a more sophisticated one. It's called OpenMP, which typically deals on a shared memory model. I won't talk much about that, but I will talk. All of my talk is really using the so-called message passing interface. And you only communicate where the programmer decides. Okay? You write a program and you communicate only when you need to. That minimizes the communication, right? Communication is your enemy. And it runs on almost all parallel computers, and it runs on clusters and Beowulf. It can also run on an expensive shared memory machine, but the one thing I certainly learned is the code I write needs to run on more than one computer. I do not write code that only runs on one machine. I do not write code that happens to only run on my desktop, because my advisor might ask me, well, now run this 100 times and explore the design space. And if I had to tell him, well, I need to recode and all my paths are hard-coded, I would expect my boss to be really mad at me. So if you're my student and you tell me that, I will be really mad at you. So here's a diagram of these parallelism. I'll just highlight them and then I'll go into the examples. So really embarrassingly parallel, people actually use that terminology, is you have one job to be done and you distribute it over n CPUs and they're completely independent and your data aggregation might be trivial. Maybe you want to see 100 files. Okay? Or maybe you have some other script where these jobs just append into one file and you're done. Right? So I would do that in a shell program or in an MPI-based parallelism. The next one would be just embarrassingly parallel, where you might have a master CPU that handles all the data and it dishes out work to the slaves over there. And then at the end of their calculation, they aggregate the result back to the master and he dishes out more work. All right, these guys don't have to talk to each other. So the slaves don't talk. They're completely independent. That's what it's called, embarrassingly parallel. And that's about as good as parallelism that you can possibly get. All right, anything else that gets more complicated is going to cut down on your advancement of reducing compute time. All right, so I give you one example of my codes where I cannot do the job in an embarrassingly parallel way. And I call that coherent parallel programming. And what I mean by coherent is there's a sequence of steps, and they're always aligned with each other. If one falls out of line, if one CPU goes away, the whole algorithm fails. All right, so I want to distribute a job over many CPUs, and I compute something. Hopefully, that's a long compute step. Then, at some point, I need to communicate to my nearest neighbor. So I'm going to say odd needs to talk to odd plus one. All right? So odd needs to talk to odd plus one, odd needs to talk to odd plus one. And then I have another communication step where I say odd needs to talk to odd minus one. So odd needs to talk to odd minus one, odd needs to talk to odd minus one, and so on. And there's maybe a periodic boundary condition on this system, so the end needs to talk. And then there's this worst step. Everybody needs to talk to everybody else because they need to share one particular result. All right, so that's communicate all to all in an aggregate sense. Now, that's the killer. You want to avoid that if you do parallel programming at all costs or minimize the use of that in your parallel program. But typically, sophisticated programs that do this coherent parallel processing where it's not embarrassingly parallel, at some point, they all tend to need to talk to each other. Now, well, there's some interesting things in MPI where you can say, you can think of these as telephone connections, right? These are independent CPUs, and they say, well, I need to talk to the right of me. I need to talk to the right of me. And you can tell this guy, well, you need to talk to the left of you. And once this telephone connection is established, so to speak, they can exchange the data in a bidirectional sense. It's not like this guy has to dial this one and tell him I need to talk to you, and they do it, and then this guy tells this guy on the left, I need to talk to you. They can do it in a bidirectional sense because the establishment of that communication direction is actually what costs most of the time. It's the latency to get the telephone call placed. So once a connection is placed, you want to talk as much as you need to and get it over with. So in MPI, you can instruct your code, talk bidirectional, for example. And then there's algorithms where you can say, where an MPI system, not everybody actually talks to everybody else, but this could be a tree, a binary tree, where 1 and 2 talk to each other, and then 3 and 4 talk to each other, and then the combination of those two talk to each other. So you can actually build a binary tree to minimize the all-to-all. But these libraries take care of that, so typically. And then after this, in my algorithm, I then work again, I compute independently, and I repeat this process. So this would be an example of a coherent parallel process or lockstep parallelism where these steps have to happen in a synchronized way. So they're not happening in a mixed way. If this CPU somehow number three gets fouled up by some means because somebody else logs into the CPU and puts a big job there, if that one guy gets slowed down, the whole chain gets slowed down. Okay? That's what I mean by lockstep or coherent. Then there's a third mechanism or a third parallelization I like to talk about that is on multiple levels. And that is actually the parallelization of a realistic engineering tool, meaning where your inputs and your requirements change over time. For example, you might have a simulation tool like NeMo where typically you may run 70 bias points over a device, but later you might want to just look at one or two bias points, what happens at that device. So maybe so the natural parallelism might be over bias points, but that number might change. So sometimes you might want to have many bias points, sometimes few. But maybe you always want to run on 64 CPUs to get the best computation possible. So maybe you have to have a lower mechanism where maybe you have some integration routine under the hood that then you can parallelize. But maybe that also is limited to four or five parallel steps. So maybe under the hood you could have an energy integration. So overall, maybe you have 100 CPUs to spend, but you need to have actually multiple levels of parallelism to really utilize these CPUs. So that's what I like to give you an example of. So this is sort of the summary. Maybe you can't easily distribute many jobs on many CPUs. Maybe they're naturally limited or they depend on from run to run what the person really wants to achieve. All right, so I'll show you an example of that later. So that's the outline of my presentation. I tried to motivate of why you want to go parallel. So I'm going to show you embarrassingly parallel, then lockstep, and then multi-level parallelism. So let me go back. The embarrassingly parallel, what I'm going to show you is a genetic algorithm-based optimization. And you can sort of, the application I built at JPL I call genes. And genes really stands for genetically engineered nanoelectronic structures, just in case you were wondering what it really stands for. All right, so how does a genetic algorithm work? It's basically a statistical exploration of a design space. What you're doing is you're taking, say, n samples on a surface. And the intuitive example I like to give you is, imagine you had to figure out where is the lowest spot in the Grand Canyon. And you want to do that with humans, to figure that out with humans, and you don't have aircraft or anything. But you can talk to each other. So now the idea is that Grand Canyon is pretty big compared to human size and the ability to hike around in this thing. And let's maybe the boundary condition is maybe it's not the lowest spot underwater, but it's the lowest spot that's not covered by water. So it's a pretty rough two-dimensional optimization surface, and you want to find the minimum. Now, the way you could do it is you could have 100 hikers around, and they can talk to each other, right? So that would be a statistical exploration, and they could talk to each other all the time and say, well, I found the lowest spot. And the guy said, well, no, I actually found the lower one. And what you want to find is not a local minimum in one valley, but a global minimum in all the valleys that exist in the Grand Canyon. So what you do is you have these 100 hikers, and then you rank them somehow. You say, okay, this guy found the lowest spot. I rank them to be number one, and actually the nth one has the second lowest spot, so I call him number two. So you reorder them, okay? You rank them somehow. And then you do something cruel, right? So these are obviously not real hikers, but you let certain guys survive and others you let die, okay? And what you do then is, out of the survivors, you evolve a new solution and you create offspring, and that fills back up your population, all right? And that you call a generation M, and now you repeat this process over again. So you have a new generation with new members, you rank them all, some survive, some die, and you go on, all right? That's a genetic algorithm. Now, it has been shown that this thing can find global minima, which is really good. It's sort of like this hiker problem that I mentioned in the Grand Canyon or many other engineering problems. And it's based on survival of good parameter sets. It's based on evolution of new parameter sets. and the survival of a diverse population. And I'll show you the concepts of what I mean by that in a second. So the question is, well, how do you create in an evolution process these new members? There's two major mechanisms that I like to show. So let's say you have a parameter set one hiker, and he is determined by, say, k parameters. In the two-dimensional example, it would be x and y coordinate, right? That would be the two parameters. But maybe in an engineering problem, you might have a 100-dimensional problem, okay? And then there's a second set, and that's another survivor, and they have also, that one also has k parameters. So what you do is you take this parameter p2 and shove it down, say, in this slot 2, and you take the element of q2 and put it back up here. So that's called crossover. So you really have a set that is different from what you had on the left, okay? That is also called sexual reproduction, or through a crossover operation. Similarly, you can have a single set like that. You span it out in its parameters, and you modify one of the parameters or two by a certain degree. That's called mutation. So what this really does is the mutation is really a fine-tuning. You sort of modify the parameter, one existing parameter, slightly. So it's one hiker sort of stepping to the right a little bit, right, and seeing is it smaller. Now, this guy here is gross exploration, because in principle, this could be a completely different set, right? And I'll show you an example of that, where let's imagine this would be x and y coordinate, okay? So let's assume one parameter is up here, say 0, 0, and one would be in the bottom, 1, 1. Okay, there's two members. So one would be sitting up here and one down here. If they exchanged one of their coordinates, their offspring would be in this corner up here, right? Or it would be in the corner on the bottom. So that's gross exploration, right? That's traveling pretty far in the search space. So the example that I have here is a pretty trivial optimization surface. It's two sync functions where there's a major peak here in the center, and there's a smaller peak off to the left here. But there's also other peaks. So this is in a surface plot. Here's a peak, here's a peak, here's a peak, here's a peak, and here's a peak. And these are valleys, these on the North Pole, east, south, and west, right? These are dips, right? And there's 100 walkers on this surface. And I'm going to use these 100 walkers as an example for the genetic algorithm optimization. And we run a genetic algorithm on these 100 walkers. And what you'll see is that they start to populate these little hills here. This guy, the big hill, this guy here. And they start to die off in these small regions here. And you'll also see that guys that come over that had accumulated on the little hill here and that ultimately need to go on the big hill, they kind of hop through the valley over here. They cross over with members over here. You'll see that in this little video. So this is where it's going to start. So here's people accumulating on the little hills, and these valleys are empty, but you can start to see guys hopping over here, right? This guy came and gone. There's another one. It's going to hop over here and it's going to hop over there, all right? And so you start to see them accumulate on the big hills here, and there's no telling on how many are going to be in the bigger one or the smaller one, but they tend to climb up on this surface. So that's pretty interesting in a sense, and they start to die out from this hill and they're going to accumulate on this guy. And once that's done, you see the whole population is now sitting on this hill. Now, that's a bad thing. That really tells you that you have no diversity whatsoever. Everybody is the same. If you wanted to explore where the peak is on this, you run a gradient algorithm with two or three steps, you're on the top. Now you have to do this for 100 guys all the time, and you do incremental improvements, right? So it's really cool to find sort of the global landscape, figure out where there's big peaks. But then at the end, you want to run a gradient approximation. So. All right, so this is an example of embarrassingly parallel because all these walkers are completely independent, right? That's this example here. It runs an MPI, runs rather efficient. Now let me show you how you want to apply this. So at TI, I built this tool called NEMO, which allows you to model resonant tunneling diodes to quite a degree of sophistication. A resonant tunneling diode is a double barrier structure, and you have the design parameter, the thickness here and the quantum well and the thickness here. You might have a doping profile, so you might have a lower bottom of the non-intentional doping and the undoped spacer layer and the low doping spacer layer. And basically what I've done here is I took an experimental data set, that's the black line here, and I asked the genetic algorithm, what geometry would you try to fit to that? And the parameters I let it vary were really five parameters only. It's symmetric, so T1, T2, T3, N1, and N2. And what we found is really that the results the GA came back with are very, very close to what we had originally experimentally verified. But I started from a random structure. So you could take this result in two ways. The one, what I actually did is I figured out what we've built without breaking it apart. The other thing is I can prove now, well, if I wanted to have achieved this curve, I could have given them a design. Okay, so I did synthesis and I did analysis in a sense, and it depends on your point of view. All right, to give you an idea, I don't have that written down here, but these are five parameters, and you could figure out what is your design space. And I thought it was sort of the order of 10 to the 10 is what I roughly remember. And I did this with 2,000 evaluations. I had to run NEMO effectively 2,000 times in this genetic algorithm approach. All right. So another problem we have is we want to do analysis in an atomistic sense. We want to represent every atom in the system and map it into a nanostructure and compute electronic structure in this nanosystem. What we know is about bulk band structures is, you know what? There's no reds in this plot. I just noticed. Whatever is red in my, okay, I'll just move on. It just makes the highlights sort of go away. So what we know about bulk band structures are typical things like the band gap or an indirect gap, the effective mass here and here, and the effective masses here. So we have for bulk band structures sort of a wish list of 10 to 30 measurable quantities that we really care about. So in the atomistic tight binding representation, what we have is we say, well, there's an S orbital talking to a P orbital on the nearest neighbor, and they might be related by some potential energy. But there is really no physical connection of this potential energy back to the physical quantities. One is a mathematical model representing matter. The other is experimental data. So what you have is a very high dimensional fitting problem, like 30 dimensional roughly. So what I've done at JPL is I established a matrix of materials, say, indium, gallium, aluminum, antimonide, arsenide, phosphide. And I matched the experimental data of gaps and masses in these nine materials. So I have a basis set now that I can put into my atomistic tight binding calculations, where now I can go back and map these atomic orbitals into physical structures and then compute physical quantities in my nanostructure. So that's sort of the first step, is the establishment of a basis. All right, so I'll show you some results with NEMO 3D later. Here's an example of a parameterization of silicon. So you know silicon in the conduction band has six valleys. And here's a relative error that I tried to achieve, or that I did achieve with respect to the band gaps and the effective masses. So the errors are just of the order of 2% or so. There was no tight binding, empirical tight binding representation of silicon that was that exact before. Now I can do calculations in silicon that I trust on the nanometer scale. All right. So now I'm going to show you the lockstep parallelism in NEMO 3D. And it's basically a multimillion atom quantum dot simulation that connects back to the establishment of the basis set I just talked about. So the goal is really to start from atomic orbitals, put them into the nanometer scale, where you might have millions of atoms, and in that nanometer scale, you compute mesoscale quantum states. Say here is an S orbital in this pyramidal quantum dot, And the reason why you might want to do is that relate that back to sensors or to computing architectures, for example, quantum dot arrays. So the physical problem is quite big. If you have 10 million atoms and you multiply that by 40 basis sets, you roughly have an eigenvector problem of 10 to the 8. That's a pretty big matrix. I don't think you want to write it down by hand, right? So the only way to do that is to put that on a parallel machine, and I tend to put it on a parallel machine I can afford. So that's a cluster. And the reason why I really want to have my own machine that I can rule over is because I actually need real compute time. So here's an example for, we demonstrated a 21 million atom system calculation. So here's number of atoms versus total compute time. So to compute four valence band and four conduction band states, we needed 12 hours on a 64 CPU machine. So that's pretty serious compute time. And typical queues that you find on other systems that are public, they give you 8 hours or 4 hours of compute time, and then they knock you off, right? But I need to really run long, so I have to have my own machine effectively, or within my own domain. I don't have to own it, but I have to be able to run for these long calculations. All right, but this is actually a major achievement. I don't know of anybody who does tight binding, empirical tight binding for realistic size devices of the order of 21 million atoms. So we compute electronic structure in that system. And what is 21 million atoms? It's a volume of roughly 80 by 80 by 80 nanometers. So in today's technology, or in next generation technology, you can dream about plopping a whole FinFET into that simulation domain and actually look at the electronic structure of that FinFET. If I knew how to treat silicon dioxide, and that's why I'm talking to Ali, right? So we want to learn how to map oxides and surfaces better into this model. All right, so we will have this tool on a NanoHub within this year in demonstration models. And let me show you what you can do with this tool. These quantum dots are so-called self-assembled quantum dots. And what that means is you might have a gallium arsenide substrate and you grow indium arsenide on it. But indium arsenide has a larger lattice constant than gallium arsenide, and it can grow only a thin layer on top of that, and then it starts to collapse into quantum dots. And they can have pyramidal shape or dome shape, and the cool thing is they're perfect crystals. So there's no real defects in this structure. But it's a strain-induced mechanism, so the strain fields are rather long. So now the question is, how long is that? How far-reaching is that? And how does it affect the electronic structure in the inside? Because we know from quantum mechanics that the wave function in this quantum dot is actually confined to a much smaller region. So what we do is in the calculation I'll show you next, is we choose an inner box in which we calculate the electronic structure, and then we choose an outer box and make that bigger and bigger and figure out what happens to the inside of the strain of the inner dot. All right, but before I show you that, I connect back to parallel computing. How do you treat a 21 million atom system? So what you can think of is a chunk of semiconductor, and we slice it into pieces like bread, okay? And each set of slice of bread contains a certain amount of atoms, and since it's a nearest neighbor tight binding model, there's only communication across that interface here. So at most, one slice has to talk to the next slice over, and so on. So we limit communication, because in parallel computing, communication is your enemy. In terms of mathematics, what you have is a block tridiagonal system like this. And in order to peel out eigenvalues out of a system like that, we need to repeatedly do a matrix vector multiply. We get this vector. We do a few operations on this vector, communicate these operations across this whole structure, and then repeat this matrix vector multiply. So that's similar to what I just described to you in terms of this parallel flow, where you do a lot of computation within one block, and then you communicate some results over to the nearest neighbor, and then you do some aggregation, and then you repeat, right? So that's here. Compute, talk to the nearest neighbor on the left, talk to the nearest neighbor on the right, aggregate some results, compute again, right? So what does that mean in terms of computing. What you want to do in parallel computing is if you double the number of CPUs, you'd like to divide your compute time by two. If you double it again, you want to divide your total compute time by two again. So that's a hyperbola. A hyperbola on a log-log scale is a straight line. Okay? So what you want to do is now compare. Let's just stay on the... So here's the scaling result for different machines for the strain calculation and for the electronic structure calculation. So let's just look at the electronic structure calculation for now. Basically, the effect that these are straight, pretty much straight lines shows that the algorithm scales really nicely. So here's this normally red line on this side is showing the perfect scaling, and these guys going up quite nicely. There's a lot of noise on this system. There's reasons for it. Let's not talk about it too much. This is a $1 million machine here, this IBM P690. We have 16 CPUs of that. If I were to put not only the performance, and you would say, well, it's much faster, right? But this machine here in blue is running even faster, and it costs about a fifth, just to give you an idea. If I actually did time versus dollars spent, right, this curve here would be lying sort of way over here, right? And that's what I care about. It's actually dollars spent for the time I'm getting out of this computer. All right. I'm going to skip over this slide and for sake of time. You can do nice mappings of how much CPU memory do you need and how big of a computing problem can you tackle. So now I want to get a little bit into simulation results. I brag that nobody else can do 21 million atoms. And what the hard part really is that you might have a quantum dot system in three dimensions. It's plotted here in one. And you want to peel out this, say, this ground state here and the excited state here. And the state separation might be 10 millielectron volt, but this whole energy range that this world exists in is 40 EV. Okay, so it's very big, and I want to distinguish 10 MeV. And what's worse is I want to peel that out of the interior spectrum. There's a lot of algorithms out there that like to converge on exterior values, so the topmost or the bottommost eigenvalue. But to get the interior out, you actually have to iterate a lot. So the interiors, this would be here an S state here in a very small box of 300,000 atoms. We see the system. Now, if we make just the surrounding box bigger, we know that from quantum mechanics that still the wave function is going to be confined into the center of the system. So the symmetry of the states shouldn't change. All it does is it's a verification that we can do 7 million and 21 million atom, and we can really pull out unique and targeted eigenstates out of a very huge system. It's sort of the verifying that we're doing things right. So once we do that, we can ask questions like this. What if we consider an interior box like this and we make the exterior strain box bigger and bigger? And what we find is that the strain effectively reaches up to 100 nanometers out of the quantum dot region, right? You can argue that you have to make the simulation domain of strain as big as 100 nanometers in order for the strain to have totally died out. Now, you can turn this around. If there is another quantum dot within the 100 nanometer range, that quantum dot is going to affect our central quantum dot due to strain. Okay, it's just similar result, different point of view. So in a sense, what you can plot here is not only, say, the effect of the quantum dot as a function of box thickness, but you can also say, if I took that as neighbor distance, you can plot what is the effect of my neighbors on my of my central dot. I'm going to skip over this. Basically, you, from a practical sense, there's finite cap layers. People grow over these quantum dots, and you can ask, what is the effect of this finite cap layer? Because it's going to modify the strain in the system. You can do strain engineering with that. The interesting part from a physics point of view is you can stack these dots experimentally and, of course, theoretically as well. And instead of having an artificial atom here, you actually get an artificial molecule. And typically, these dots, the second dot is larger than the first dot. So you would expect that the ground state is actually residing in the topmost dot, and the second state would be in the bottommost dot. So it's sort of like bringing two slightly modified hydrogens closer. And if they're far away from each other, they're just independent quantum dots. And if you bring them closer, you expect to see a molecular orbital, so a bonding and an antibonding state. And if you do indeed do this experiment, you start from quantum dots that are 130 nanometers apart, and you bring them closer and closer, you can see that the states start to separate, and you get the bonding and antibonding system that you expect to see. But you can do it in a realistically sized device, and that's what makes quantum dots really interesting. It's sort of a quantum mechanics laboratory at a nanometer scale that you can access. So from a physics point of view, it's very interesting, but it's also very interesting from engineering, because people are building lasers, for example, or detectors. And they build that with stacked quantum dots. And here's a very ideal system where, say, these quantum dots were all the same. If you did an electronic structure calculation on that, which requires 6 million atoms, what you'll find is you have 7 identical dots, and these dots would develop a sort of a band. And from even analytical exercises, you can argue that the topmost and the bottommost state should be roughly symmetric, and the second pair and the third pair should be symmetric. You can derive that from analytical results. Now, what you can't do is, if you now start to consider strain in the system, the strain is starting to distort the system significantly. And in order to get a reasonable result, you have to have 45 million atoms in the system. In the strain calculation, what you find is that actually the ground state of this overall system is pushed to the bottom of these dots. So the strain in the system actually breaks the symmetry of the structure. And what you thought you had derived as a very nicely symmetric system becomes rather asymmetric. If you wanted to design a laser around that, you would want to know about that. So the ground state is at the bottom. You can't really derive that analytically, and I don't think anybody else in the world can compute this right now. Okay, now another engineering application is multi-level parallelism. So NEMO-1D really is probably the first nano-CAT tool that was built. And what we did at JPL is we put in dynamic parallelism into it. So NEMO is built on NEGEF on the core. It's a green function theory with the boundary conditions. What you have around it is you can plug in physics really nicely, like phonons, dopants, Allo disorder, interface roughness, band structure, and charging. But to really make it useful, we had to do a lot of software engineering. So there is a documentation, there's material database, there's a graphical user interface, there's a library of examples. It's written in a hybrid C Fortran way, has grid generators and resonance finders. And this whole thing is actually a pretty big monster with 250,000 lines of code. So it's a pretty big tool. And if you'd say, well, now I want to parallelize it, most people go, you got to be crazy to dive into 200,000 lines of code and try to parallelize that. But it's actually not that hard. The physics behind this tool, or why people were interested in it, the major funding agency that wanted to see this, they were interested in double barrier resonant tunneling diodes. So it's a double barrier structure like that. It has resonance states, and here are seas of electrons. And what you do is you apply a voltage. And as you apply the voltage, you pull in the resonance in the sea of electrons, and the current starts to rise. If you increase the voltage further, this resonance is under the sea of electrons. There is no supply anymore. Consequently, the current goes down. And if you increase the voltage further, you pull the second state into the sea of electrons, and you start to conduct again. Now, this I call Mickey Mouse diagrams to explain to somebody how this RTD works. These devices are not Mickey Mouse devices. They can be built. What you see here in black is actually the prediction before experiment. And the dots are actually 12 different IV curves coming from two different wafers with three different mesa sizes and two bias directions overlaying. So this shows two things. Number one, you can predict the performance with this NEMO tool. Number two is you can build the devices repeatedly. Well, unfortunately, silicon never ran out of steam and continued to grow, so the interest in this resonant tunneling diode has pretty much died out. Nevertheless, it's really the only quantum device that operates at room temperature. And to build a tool that is fundamentally quantum mechanical is still what we're after, even on a nanometer scale. So what has to be evaluated on the bottom is some transport kernel, maybe a transmission coefficient or something that needs to be integrated over two dimensions, the total energy, which is the transport energy, and a transverse momentum in this that is transverse to the transport direction. So what you really have is you might have a loop over all bias points. So you want to evaluate this over many bias points. And for each bias point, what you do is you guess the charge in the device, and then you have a Poisson loop, okay, where you need to converge on charge and potential. So you guess a potential, you stick that into your quantum simulation, and inside your quantum simulation, you do this double integral. You do a K integral and an energy integral. So this is a parallelizable loop over here, and that's your first candidate, because it's the outermost, right? You touch the least in the code. Then you cannot parallelize this, because this is really an iterative process. You do not know your intermediate steps, right? Each step is dependent on the previous one. You can't parallelize that. But doing these K integrals, you can parallelize, because these individual T's here have nothing to do with each other. They're independent from one K point to the next. And then on the lowest level, you have an energy integral, and you can parallelize that again. So you have three opportunities to parallelize. And of course, most people don't do that. What most people do is they say, well, forget about this K integral, and I can do some parallel. I do the parallel integration analytically. It's called a Suisaki approximation. Unfortunately, that completely breaks down for typical resonant tunneling diodes. And the reason is, here's a density of states in gray. And in black, you see the band edge of a resonant tunneling diodes. And there is an emitter-bound state in resonance here with a central state. And they form a bonding and antibonding pair at a particular bias point. Now, if you assumed that you have parabolic bands in the transverse direction, this whole picture should just shift up in sync with increasing K. But what happens really is that for a different K, at the very same bias point, these states are detuned from each other. They're not moving up in sync. They're actually being decoupled. It's almost like it looks like a different bias point. So that means the coupling of these states actually depends on K and voltage. So this double integral really is needed to do the right physics. And what happens is, if you do not include this transverse integral, you, instead of computing an experimental curve like that, you compute something that looks okay here and looks okay here, but at the resonance point, you completely overpredict current, because you're assuming all these states run in sync and everybody is in resonance at the same bias point for the same K. Well, that just isn't what happens. So you can do a couple of approximations, but what you really want to do is compute a curve that is in black like this, where you get the peak right, you get the valley roughly right, and you get the turn on right. And in order to do that, double integrals.
Why do they get electrostatic?
I'll explain at the end, okay? It's not electrostatics. It's really, you have a molecular interaction, and your transverse dispersion is different in the left and the right. And what that means really here is, I can go back. So here is a... this bottom here in the quantum well is deeper. So this state actually sits higher in energy than this state. Okay, if you look at the bottom of the conduction band, so this is roughly 50 millielectron volts deep here, right? But here in the center, it's actually deeper still, right? Because it's pulled down deeper. Well, that means that this state effectively sits higher in above the conduction band, okay? And the conduction band is non-parabolic. So it's for a higher K point, this state moves at a different pace than this state. It has to do with the non-parabolicity of the material, not the charging. And we can talk about it in more detail. I can give you a sketch. I don't have the sketch in the presentation. Okay, so there's these three different levels of parallelism: loop over bias points, loop over K points, and loop over energy. I'm going to show you the results of those fast. So what I'm doing here is sort of being devil's advocate. I'm saying I want to run on 64 CPUs because I have that machine, right? But I'm, for physical reasons, I might be interested in 70 bias points, right? I just make that choice. What happens is that, well, first of all, let me back off. If I said I wanted to be interested in 500 bias points, what you would see is a performance that would probably be completely on the exact perfect scaling, right? But if you only have 70 bias points, it's very clear that roughly at half of those 70, you're going to start tapering out and having CPUs sitting idle, right? So overall, your speed up is basically pegged to some 36, even though you wanted to have some 64 CPUs working all the time. So obviously, if I had a different point of view, if I wanted to just run 4 bias points, there wouldn't be much point in running on 64 CPUs, right? And my key point is that there's nothing magical about the 70. It depends on your experiment that you actually do as an engineer. And that might change. That criterion might change, right? So just doing running on parallelism in the bias is not good enough. So here's another one, where what we do is here's a transmission coefficient at k equal to 0, and there is almost parabolic dispersions like this, and then for a different k point here, you get a different transmission coefficient. Okay, and for the question you just asked, actually, if this is not perfectly parabolic, if this is sort of starting to be non-parabolic, like this case, then this stage, this transmission coefficient on the right, is running at a different pace than a parabolic dispersion from that. Okay, and what we do is we need to integrate over these different transmission coefficients, and we get a rather smooth function for this. So this is sort of the integral over this is this point here. The integral over this is maybe this point here. And for higher k's, it dies out. All right? So this is a rather smooth function. That means we don't need to have a whole lot of k points to resolve that function. We want to make sure we get that drop off here, but that's about it. So again, that's a real result. I typically get around with just 21 k points. Okay? So you can argue, well, if I had 64 CPUs, that's not going to parallelize very well. And indeed, you can go up to, say, 12 or 18 or so. That's CPUs. That's how good you're going to be in the parallelization. Actually, it would be, yeah. So the third level was energy parallelization, right? So here's, again, the perfect result. And the problem is that we need to do these integrals over these spiky functions, okay? So you're peeling a needle out of a haystack. And what we do is basically do an adaptive integration. We do not know a priori where these resonances sit. So the closer what we do is we do an integral, and then we insert points between the neighbors and say, well, did it make a difference? If it made a difference, we insert more. If it made a difference, we insert more. And if it doesn't make a difference, we leave that untouched. So that is sort of how you home in on this resonance here. But that means if you have two resonances in the system, at most you're going to do is add two more nodes for every bias point, for every trial and error, right? So at some point, you might have started out with 200 nodes, which sounds like really good parallelism, but at the end, you're tweaking just here, right? So you're going to taper out at a parallel performance of just 12 or something, all right? So again, it doesn't help you a lot if you had 64 CPUs and you had an algorithm like that. So what you want to do is combine these things. So here's the three curves that I had shown you combined. So current parallelization is the best, K is the next best, and then the finest fine grain is this guy. And here is the same curve and speed up of what I had shown before. So what we can do is this tri-level parallelism. I'm going to show you a result of two levels. Where here is the curve in black here is the just purely current parallel, and the guy in blue is parallel in current and in K, and indeed you get the speed up that is significantly larger. So you run at 70% efficiency rather than 50% efficiency. You can do the similar thing with current and K, and you increase your efficiency, and that is pretty much where stop my presentation on this, where effectively we were able to do with an engineering tool like that, where you have degrees of freedom of how, where your physics determines number of bias points and K points and E, and number of CPUs is sort of you take it as a given, and you can do get better results, physical results, you can get better bistability results, etc. So that is the outline of the presentation here. Embarrassingly parallel genetic algorithm, lockstep parallelism, and multi-level parallelism. And just for kicks, I wanted to show you that at JPL we also did other things you might have seen now in the National Geographic. These are images I just pulled off the website at JPL. So these are all little mosaics that were put together, and we worked on parallelizing this as well. So same principles hold, and we had really nice impact where we reduced the computation time it takes for one of these mosaics from roughly 2 hours to 2 or 3 minutes going to parallel. So at the end, again, nanohub.org. I'd really like you guys to consider whether you can contribute to online simulation, where you can, of course, have courses, learning modules, seminars, collaborations, and maybe your software, right? So when you graduate at some point, it would be cool if you could go to your new employer and say, well, by the way, I wrote these nice papers, but I also am an engineer, and I put my tool, that is my PhD thesis, essentially, on the NanoHub, and you can check it out. Okay, that's a selling argument if you want to go to industry or government labs. If you wanted to go into academia, you will have to write your career proposal or outreach proposals, and you will have to reach people, right? So you can say, well, by the way, for my PhD, I've already engaged hundreds of users with my software that I wrote to my PhD. I know how to engage my community, all right? Thank you very much.